You are listening to Radio Aryan.
Welcome to Aryan Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 12th of August 2019, and you're listening to me, St. Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAryan.com. Well, I'm very pleased to say that I have my co-host with me today, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm doing very well. It's been a good day, good weekend so far, and things are looking good for the future, I think.
Excellent, excellent. Yes, yes, they are looking good for the future. I think we are going to get Brexit through from that point anyway. And we also have a very encouraging poll that I want to talk about today. I do like these polls. I enjoyed discussing that poll last week, you know, because it gives us an insight into the way that the country is thinking, and then we can apply nationalist thought to it. And last week's one was a bit depressing, all this depression that these youngsters are suffering from. And the poll we're going to discuss this week is, I think it's great, really good. But we're going to get to that later on. I know you've been looking into the Brexit issue and the numbers in Parliament, I believe. So let's start off with that, I think.
Okay. It was just interest on my part, really, just to see quite how the individual numbers stacked up. I was a bit sort of interested in the position of John Bercow, the Speaker of the House of Commons, and quite what his position would be, because he seems to be he's somebody who came from a Conservative background, but who, as Speaker of the House, has to be impartial, but who has kind of shown some sort of sympathies with Labour on occasions. And so his support for a Conservative government, particularly one that's going to be taking us out of the European Union, would appear not to be something that can be taken for granted. But also I discovered, because I hadn't really sort of, I wasn't actually consciously aware of this, that the Speaker also has three assistant speakers, and neither the Speaker nor the three assistant speakers normally vote in Parliament. And so their votes don't count. And the Speaker only votes if there is a tie between the pro and the anti groups with regard to any particular issue. But it's the numbers stack up in that we've got 310 Conservative MPs, with one of them, Eleanor Lang, who is one of the assistant speakers, therefore not voting. But that 310, and added to the DUP's vote of 10 votes, gives you 320 for the Conservatives. And then you've got the anti-Brexit groups, where Labour have got 247 MPs, but two of those are assistant speakers of the House, and so they don't vote. So they've got 245 plus the 35 SNP, the 13 Lib Dems, the 5 Change UK, 4 for Plaid Cymru, the 1 for the Green Party, 16 independents, giving them a total of 319 if they manage to marshal all those people together in one block. And so, as you can see, we're in a situation where we've got 320 that are potentially pro-vet Brexit MPs and 319 potentially anti-Brexit MPs. The situation is further complicated by virtue of the fact that some of the Conservative MPs have been threatening that they might vote against the government when Parliament reconvenes. And so that makes it a slightly more complicated situation, and not quite so certain of Boris Johnson can't be quite so certain of having this majority in the House of Commons. But then it leaves there are the three assistant or deputy speakers of the House of Commons, the Speaker of the House of Commons, which are four, and then there are seven MPs who are labelled in documents as being abstentionists. And when you look at these abstentionists, they are the MPs that are elected for Sinn Féin, and Sinn Féin don't take up their seats in the House of Commons. But what I wanted to look at, first of all, is that there has been a report during the course of this last week where John McDonald, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, I think he is, or something of that position, he's been stating that or hinting that the Labour, that a future Labour government might offer a referendum on Scottish independence in order to gain the support of the Scottish Nationalist Parliament in Westminster in order to achieve a vote of no confidence in Boris Johnson and therefore forestall Brexit. And it's just interesting that the Scottish National Party have been campaigning to get another referendum so that they can hopefully on their part they will get a vote in favour of Scottish independence so that they can achieve their independence from the United Kingdom. And it just seemed to me extremely hypocritical that the Labour Party should, on the one hand, have a position asserting that independence from a political union is good for Scotland and can be settled by a referendum of the people, but a independence from a political union is bad for the UK, and that justifies Parliament overriding the result of the referendum that was taken in 2016. So the Labour Party, if they do promise the Scots Nationalist Party a referendum in return for them supporting the Labour Party's call for no confidence in Boris Johnson in order to scupper Brexit, that would then be an act of rank hypocrisy on the part of the Labour Party. And so that's something that people ought to think about, really.
Well, there's also, I was just going to say, they've also come out in favour of the union and said that they wouldn't support a Scottish independence referendum. And the head of Scotland Labour has come out and said this, and that's the official position of the Scottish Labour Party and of the British Labour Party. And now John McDonnell has apparently gone against that. I believe he did this either at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. It may possibly be that he said this when he was sucking up to the SNP. But he's basically gone against the stated position of the Labour Party, as well as the total hypocrisy of doing it, as you just outlined there, Max. I just wanted to add that to it.
Yeah, that's a perfectly good observation there. Also, the same situation exists with regard to the Welsh Nationalists, because the Welsh Nationalists have been campaigning for greater and greater independence from the UK over the years, and one can quite imagine that if Labour do decide to offer a referendum to the Scots Nationalists, that they would also perhaps offer a referendum to the Welsh Nationalists, and that again would be an act of rank hypocrisy for the very same reasons. And ditto any situation where the Labour Party might offer a referendum to Sinn Féin on the continued membership of the UK, the continued membership of Ulster within the UK, for their support in terms of a vote of no confidence. But as I said earlier on, Sinn Féin don't actually take up their seats in Parliament. They're abstentionists, they don't take up their seat because they believe that if they were to take up their seats, first of all, that it would be an acknowledgement of the sovereignty that the British Parliament has over Northern Ireland. And in order to take up their seats as well, they would have to make a pledge of allegiance to the Crown, which, again, they don't want to do. So that being quite principled in actually not wanting to pledge allegiance to the Crown and in not wanting to acknowledge the sovereignty of Parliament. And I just wonder where, if there was a very close call vote of no confidence, that there probably might be some bright sparks within the Labour Party that might be thinking, "Cool, if we offered a referendum to Sinn Féin, then Sinn Féin might be prepared to bend their credentials in terms of, or bend their principles rather, in supporting, taking up their positions within Parliament, just so that they can vote in order to abolish, pass a vote of no confidence and therefore bring down the British government and prevent us from having our independence from the European Union. But again, all of this would all be an act of rank hypocrisy on the part of everybody involved in trying to scupper Brexit, because the principle is that if you apply one principle in one respect, you've got to apply the same principle in any similar situation with regard to a nation wanting their independence. So this then brings us to the situation, the question really, which is that if we nationalists value freedom and self-determination, and if we advocate that these are good for the UK, are we not being hypocritical by opposing these same things for Scotland, Wales and Ireland? Because this sort of principle cuts both ways. And my answer to that is a very firm no. It's not us being hypocritical, because firstly, the Scots, the Welsh and the Irish nationalists are not really nationalists. They are internationalists. They are globalists. They don't actually want freedom and self-determination for their people. They want to detach themselves from the UK solely out of a kind of historic spite over the rivalry that there's been between England and the other parts of the United Kingdom in the past. They want to detach themselves from the UK solely so that they can then become very small vassal states within an undemocratic proto-Marxist European Union. And so their campaign for freedom from Britain is only so that they can then make themselves subservient to another master, basically. And so their nationalism isn't a nationalism that would result in their people having freedom and self-determination. It's a perverted form of nationalism that would result in their people being even more thoroughly dominated than even they imagine they are dominated by England at being part of the United Kingdom.
Plastic nationalism. That's what it is. Plastic nationalism is what I would call it. I would totally agree with you there. I mean, that's why I wouldn't support their independence movements, because they're not independence movements. They're communist parties. And in the case of Plaid Cymru, they're going directly against the wishes of Wales. Wales voted overwhelmingly to leave the EU, and Plaid Cymru, ever since then, have done all that they possibly can do to sabotage Brexit. And they've been quite open at that. They've been quite openly saying, well, the Welsh people are stupid. They don't know what's best for them. We know what's best for them. So that's why we're going against their vote. Plaid Cymru, they've got very little legitimacy, very little support in Wales. They're the total globalists. It's the same with them. The SNP there. I must say, I'm quite impressed with Sinn Féin, as you say there, with their consistency in refusing to take their seats and vote on this, because we know that they would much rather stay within the EU, and they are sticking to their principles by not going in the Parliament. And that would be an easy way for them to scupper it, and they haven't. So I have to give them credit for sticking to their principles there, even if we don't give them credit for much else. One other point I would just add, all this fuss about the backstop as well. They've been saying, well, we've got to have the backstop because otherwise it would mean splitting up the UK. And that's what Labour have been saying. That's what all the political parties have been saying. We must have the backstop because otherwise it would split up the UK. So we've got that hypocrisy to it as well. Now that they're offering deals to Scotland, which would split up the UK. So it's just total hypocrisy there. And also, I mean, even if they do have a vote of no confidence, what is that going to do? It's going to do nothing, because it just means that they'll have to have a general election, which will take at least 6 weeks for them to do. And we're supposed to be, I mean, it's the law that we're going to leave the EU on October the 31st. Whether there's a deal, whether there isn't a deal, that's the law that we leave. Whether or not they have a general election, that doesn't impact on the law at all. They're really scraping at the bottom of the barrel, I feel now, Max. Do you want to add anything else to that before we move on to some of this news?
Well, only that the English Parliament, well, the British Parliament, has its faults, but it is not an inherently undemocratic system. It's regarded as being the mother of parliaments. It's only become undemocratic as a result of decades of disproportionate power exercised within our culture and within our society by the mass media and by ethnic minority groups that control the mass media. But as far as the EU is concerned, the EU is an entity that is inherently undemocratic, because it's been modelled on the Soviet Union, and by, although some people may say, well, we're no better off if we leave the European Union because we'll still have an undemocratic parliament here in the UK as opposed to an undemocratic parliament in the European Union. The advantage to us in leaving the European Union is that it is a much smaller problem to correct the undemocratic issues that relate to the British Parliament than it is for us to try and tackle the lack of democracy that's inherent within the European Union, which is a very, very much larger entity. Before you can actually correct the lack of democracy, you need to be able to gain control politically of the state in which you live. And if the state in which you live is a relatively small state composed of roughly 60 million people, then that's a very much smaller problem than a very large state composed of like 300 million people thereabouts. And so by leaving the European Union, we're making the problem, the other problems that we've then got to tackle later on of parliamentary democracy and also then of the survival of our people by putting an end to mass immigration, all these kind of other problems then become much smaller problems because, you know, we've only got to be able to control the political environment within a relatively small country instead of a very large continent.
Yeah, and the EU was created to be like that. It was created to be a copy of the Soviet Union, whereas the British Parliament wasn't created to be like that. And there are mechanisms within it that can still be used to turn things around. Yeah, I agree with all of that, Max, and you're bringing up the problems that we have there with multiculturalism. Of course, they rear their head every day. But last week we had a particularly nasty incident of vibrancy that took place over here. And that was a white policeman that was just doing a routine traffic stop because he has a suspicion that the person driving the vehicle may not have actually had any insurance. And as he went up to talk to the guy that was within the vehicle, he jumped out with a machete. And it appears that he tried to behead this white police officer. Fortunately, he didn't actually get to behead him. He scalped him instead, almost chopped his whole thumb off. That was hanging off and had to be sewed back on. And thankfully, the police officer, PC Stuart Alton, he had a taser. And he was able to taser this Muslim, it was, basically. It was a black Muslim. There's no inference that it was a terrorist act or anything like that. It was just this Muslim didn't want to be stopped by the police. And, you know, and apparently our police are getting attacked all the time. They've also got this problem in Germany when the police, you know, they have to be very, very wary when they go up to someone that's non-white now, because they could have a knife, they could be armed. The chances are they're going to attack them over the smallest thing. I mean, this is a really small issue, and it just shows that, you know, the police can't even do a traffic stop now. They can't even be safe doing a traffic stop because of the multiculturalism that we have in this country. I mean, this was a really, really savage attack. It was all across the newspapers. And when you first heard it, it was a man had tried to attack him with a machete. And, you know, I think everybody in the country knew straight away that had to be a non-white person because of the weapon that was used, because it was a machete. I mean, that's a non-white weapon of choice that they use. But nobody's that's pointing right out this. Go on.
No. I mean, I remember being quite amused because when I saw the account reported in the news, first of all, and where it just said a man, I remember remarking to my wife that almost certainly this was going to turn out to be a non-white person. And the following day, there was an article, I think it was on the Daily Mail website, where they gave an account of this, and they showed a photograph of the police officer, I believe, and then they showed a drawing of the assailant, and the assailant was drawn in such a way that he looked like just a slightly brown-skinned European with very otherwise very European features, and I thought that didn't really mesh with the person's name, and it didn't really mesh with my expectation. And the following day, the same article was there that where they added some bits to it as little bits of extra news had come in. And they showed on the header page of the Daily Mail website this photograph, which consisted of showing an image of the policeman who had been injured. But then the same drawing was shown next to him. But if you clicked on the actual article, then when the article opened up, the original drawing had been replaced by another drawing which showed somebody who quite obviously was of African origin. And I thought it was amusing that on the actual header page, they'd got this, that they'd got the police officer, and by the side of the police officer, this drawing showing him looking far more European. But then inside, when you clicked on the picture, there was then this other image of showing him looking far more African. The very next day, the header page of the Daily Mail had the police officer and the more African looking drawing. And then when you clicked on the article and looked inside, there was the image of the police officer, and by the side of it, the photograph of the assailant showing him to look almost identical to the African drawing that had been shown before. So it's like almost like the Daily Mail in denial, first of all. We don't really want to actually admit that this person was of non-white origin. We don't want to actually admit this person is of African origin. But then slowly, as the news permeated through, they then felt that they couldn't resist it any longer, and they had to actually come clean on the whole thing. It's just a pity that the news media in this country are so biased in that way. You know, whenever there is any kind of issue of this sort where the assailant concerned is white, it's always made apparent right from the very beginning. People have now come to learn that when there is no description of an assailant in any kind of issue of this sort or any kind of incident of this sort, that they know that it's the media trying to do a cover-up.
Yeah, I think they were forced into showing that picture, really, because once they'd released the name of the assailant, then everybody knew he was non-white, because, of course, it was a Muhammad. You know, Muhammad has got to be the most prolific criminal that we have in Britain today, this person called Muhammad, I would suggest. There's probably more Muhammads in our prisons than any other name at all. And as I've said so many times before, all these acts of terrorism, they tell us who it is that inspired them, that told them to carry out the act of terrorism. It's Allah. It's Allah and Muhammad that the police should be going after if they wish to protect us. And you were bringing up the way that the media covers this just there, Max. And this next news story I've got here, that concerns that as well. And it's actually about the Sikhs. The Sikh community are absolutely fed up to the back teeth of being lumped in with these Muslim pedophile gangs, basically, because the mainstream media likes to refer to the Muslim pedophile gangs as Asian grooming gangs. And of course, when they say Asian, that includes these Sikhs as well. And they are absolutely fed up with it. They've actually written a strongly worded letter to the mainstream media. The Network of Sikh Organizations, the NSO, and that also includes Hindus, has called on the media to stop referring to grooming gangs that are predominantly comprised of perpetrators from a Pakistani Muslim heritage as Asian, which inaccurately incorporates much of the British Hindu and Sikh communities. I'll just stop there and point out that over here it might be that it's Pakistanis that run these rape gangs. In Finland, it's Somalis. In France, it's another type of black Muslim. In Sweden, it's another type of black Muslim. So it's a Muslim problem. And of course, it's associated with non-whites. It's just that over here in Britain, we have, I guess, probably more Pakistanis than any other type of Muslim. And that's why it's a Pakistani Muslim rape gang. But the problem is with these Muslim gangs all over Europe. And it just depends on the concentration of what the highest concentration is of the Muslims that they have in the country. But this report that they say here, or this letter, British Sikh and Hindu groups have consistently objected to the use of the word Asian to describe those convicted in sexual grooming gang cases like Rochdale, Rotherham, Oxford and Telford, the NSO said. This cowardly non-specific description of the perpetrators continues to be used in the British press to describe men of predominantly Pakistani Muslim heritage convicted in grooming gang cases. We believe this is in part due to the fear of offending Muslims, Mr. Singh wrote, adding that the word also serves to mask the fact that girls from Hindu and Sikh communities have historically fallen foul of grooming gangs themselves. The common denominator in such cases is the deliberate targeting of non-Muslim girls, which we believe should be categorised by the police as a hate crime. I thought that was really, really good there, that he you know, because this is someone from a non-white community that is saying that this should be categorised as a hate crime. It's non-Muslims that are being targeted here. 95%, I guess, or 99% of the victims are white, and the other percentage are the Sikh girls. And this goes back to the partition of India. This is a problem that they've always had with the Muslims over there, treating the Sikh girls, treating the Hindu girls as if they were nothing but meat. And this problem is now here in Britain as well. And this word Asian, I mean, when the Americans hear that, they think of the Chinese, and they think, what, you've got a problem with Chinese rape gangs? It's a very, very cowardly way to describe them, this non-specific way. So thank you very much to these Sikh organizations. I'm pleased they sent this letter out, Max. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I support the views you expressed here. I think that the thing is that, as I've said on many occasions, a multicultural society is a society that inevitably encourages the communities within it to adopt an in-group, out-group approach to life, where they exercise in-group preference. And if they're going to commit a criminal act, then they apply the opposite, and they apply an out-group preference, i.e. that they choose a victim that's not part of their in-group more often than not. Not in every case, but more often than not. And so we have this situation where wherever there is a multicultural society, there is far more violence committed by the ethnic minorities practicing in-group preference or out-group preference in terms of choosing a victim. And so you end up with a society which has a heightened level of crime, and where the crimes are disproportionately associated with conflict between the ethnic minority and the host community. I think as far as Islam is concerned, it has got a far more pronounced preference in terms of in-group and out-group preference, simply because the one of the primary principles of the religion is to treat believers well, and to treat the unbelievers badly, and in some cases quite sort of savagely. And so what we have is a situation where one of the main principles of the religion tends to encourage this in-group, out-group preference, and so it exacerbates the situation that is bad to begin with, and just makes it worse.
No, it's just common sense, really, isn't it? I mean, if you've got a small community of one particular type of person, and you've got a few criminals in that community, they're not going to want to be committing crimes against the members of that community, because, you know, they'll be dealt with really savagely by that community if they do. So it only makes sense that they're going to pick on people that are outside of that community. So, you know, it's just a recipe for disaster, multiculturalism, putting all these different ethnicities living in the same territory. And that's before you get to Islam, as you pointed out there, that treats non-Muslims as little better than slaves, and he's encouraged to as well by the imams. I mean, they may not openly say, yes, we agree with these rape gangs, but they will point out that these girls wouldn't have been raped if they were covered up, if they weren't wearing perfume, if they weren't wearing mini skirts. I mean, this is what an imam said after the Cologne mass sexual abuse that took place on the New Year's Eve. The imam over there, that's exactly what he said. If the girls weren't dressed the way that they were, then this wouldn't happen. And of course, what he means by that is, well, if they were to be wearing a burqa and covering themselves up, if they were to go along with Islam and claim to be Muslims, then it wouldn't happen to them because they wouldn't be seen as fair game. And this is the way that Islam works. It's not about people freely making a choice to join a religion because they've investigated it and realized that it's the truth. It's about forcing people to go along with it. It's about forcing the whole world to go under Sharia law. That's the main difference between it and these other religions. You try and explain that to people, and because people are just used to Christianity, they just assume that all religions have the same goals in mind that Christianity does. And this is encouraged by the UN when it says, you know, and by the Catholic Church now as well, that says there are many different ways to God and it's all just one God and the different religions are different ways of worshipping that God. But that's just not true. All the religions are very different from one another. They're quite clearly not all worshipping the same God. And, you know, I'm just glad that these Sikhs have spoken out about this and written this letter. Whether the mainstream media will take any notice of it, that's another different point altogether. I doubt whether they will take any notice of it at all. But I did find a very encouraging poll last week. I actually found it in Breitbart, and it's mainly concerned with Zoomers, Generation Z or Gen Z or whatever you prefer to call them. And I've been very encouraged by the Zoomers. There was reports last year that far more of them are conservative than ever before. They seem to be embracing traditionalism. They seem to be wanting to get married. They are not impressed with the gay agenda. These are all the sort of things that polls have been finding out. And this particular poll appears to be showing that the majority of the Zoomers wish we had fascism. Now, that's not the exact wording, but that is basically what seems to be being said here. A poll has revealed that 2/3 of young people want a strong man as a leader, while more than 1/4 would be happy with the military leading the country, revealing that younger generations are turning their back on decades of liberalism. And this is actually a large poll. It's over 5,000 people. So 2/3 of youngsters want a strong man as leader. And, you know, that to me, I mean, that's what fascism is, isn't it? You have one guy at the top. He's responsible for everything. If it goes wrong, he is to blame. If it goes right, then he is the one to praise. Obviously, they're probably pointing towards people like Donald Trump as a strong man. But you've also got Kim Jong-un. He's referred to as a strongman leader. In fact, he's probably the archetype today of the strongman leader would probably be Kim Jong-un. I mean, this is amazing. 2/3 of young people want a strongman as leader.
Yeah, I think this is an example of the principle that's you sometimes see expounded by people, where they say that if you have a nation with a strong leader, that strong leader tends to result in heightened wealth and security for that nation, and that heightened wealth and security creates a good feeling for the people within the population, so they feel they can be a little bit more generous, so they then become far more liberal, and by becoming liberal they then elect weak leaders, and those weak leaders then start to make the wrong kind of decisions, and the society then goes into decline. There's declining wealth and declining security, and that declining wealth and declining security results in an uncomfortable time and an undesirable time for the people of the nation, and they again start then to yearn for a strong leader to put things right, and so it becomes a kind of a cyclical thing that a strong leader then eventually gets elected. The strong leader then has to take sometimes harsh action in order to put things right, but then eventually puts things right, and the wealth and security improves again. And because people feel wealthy and secure, they start to have feelings of liberalism, which then means that they then start to choose weak leaders and so on and so on. And I think that's perhaps, you know, we're in a situation where the pendulum has swung just about as far as it can go to the sort of liberal left. And that pendulum is now starting to swing back the other way as the youth of our nation begin to realise the fruits of a liberal regime, effectively.
Yeah, it's like a cycle, isn't it? And they used to refer to it as effeminate leaders. And that's what we've got today, is effeminate leaders. And I also can't help but thinking maybe this is a reaction to Theresa May, who instead of being a strong man was a weak woman. And that's the only way that you can look at it. With a poll of 5,073 people conducted by Hanbury Strategy between the 21st and 28th of June and published last Thursday by conservative think tank Onward, found that across all age groups, 58% of people think that having a strong leader who does not have to bother with Parliament would be a good way to run the United Kingdom. That's amazing. A strong leader who does not have to bother with Parliament. That's 60% of people just in general say that they don't want democracy. That's what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, I think one of the other things that we see in the work that's being attempted by Donald Trump in the United States is that Donald Trump has come in. He's got a rather more right-wing agenda than the news media and the mass media in the United States are happy with. And so what you've then got is the mass media in the United States, together with the liberal left, all conspiring, all doing everything they possibly can to impede everything that Trump wants to do. And so that every decision he makes is attacked, every policy he advocates is attacked and undermined, and all these bureaucratic impediments are placed in his way. And that isn't lost on the people generally. So what's happening at the moment in the United States is that the population of the United States is witnessing what happens when you have somebody who is a relatively strong leader compared with who the people have come before, but who is having every impediment placed in his way by the supposedly democratic institutions of the state, who aren't acting in a way that supports the will of the people, that are in fact placing not just impediments in the way of Donald Trump, they're also impeding the policies that he's advocated, that people have voted for. And so therefore the political establishment in the United States is impeding the will of the people. So what the next step will be, that the general population of within the United States, those people that have voted for Trump in the past, will think, actually, we need a system of government that enables somebody who's a strong leader to lead, and where all these bureaucratic impediments are swept away so that they can actually do the job that we elect them to do. And so that may well be the next step along the progression. And I think that people who take delight in placing all these bureaucratic impediments in front of Donald Trump, need to think again. And the same thing's happening here in the UK, really, where we had the referendum. The referendum went the opposite way to the way in which the political establishment would like. We then had Theresa May, who came along, who was a very half-hearted leader, taking us ostensibly towards Brexit, but stumbling every step of the way and finding that every bureaucratic impediment was being placed in her way, and finding herself unable to overcome those bureaucratic impediments. She's now been replaced by Boris, and Boris is a far more ebullient, far more bullish kind of a leader. He seems to be making some progress now in the direction of Brexit. But again, as far as he's concerned, we can see all of the agents of the old British establishment all trying to do everything they possibly can in terms of mustering support for a vote of no confidence as soon as Parliament opens, in terms of mustering the support in Parliament to introduce legislation that will make it impossible for Brexit to proceed. So again, they're going against the wishes of the people, because they're going against the vote for us to leave the European Union. So they're again using all the bureaucratic machinery and the democratic machinery, effectively, they're using this democratic machinery for perverse purposes in order to frustrate the will of the people. And again, as I say, that they should think again about doing this sort of thing, because what they're inviting is for the public to recognise what they're doing and to say, well, actually, what we need is a leader like Boris, but with all of the bureaucratic and democratic impediments swept away. And they might just get that if they push too hard.
Well, I hope they do get that. I mean, that's what, you know, that's what we had before is a monarchy. It's just fascism is that the person rises from among the people rather than, being part of the royal family. As you point out there about Donald Trump, I mean, what this shows is that the media is way out of touch with the people, because if 60% of the people want a strong leader, you know, that means 60% of the people in Britain probably support Donald Trump. And one example of what happens when the deep state gets in the way of the policies of the leader is this attack in El Paso. They're blaming Donald Trump for that. But if he'd managed to actually get his wall put up, none of those attacks would be happening, because the people would have the faith in the government to actually carry out the will of the people. And they wouldn't think that there's no hope in the government ever doing what we vote for, so we'll take the law into our own hands and go out and shoot a load of people in a Walmart. That would not have happened if they hadn't frustrated the will of the people and allowed Trump to put his wall up. I just hope we don't end up with things like that happening over here in Britain, which, you know, probably Prime Minister Johnson, Boris Johnson, I mean, he's probably thought about that. Look, if we don't leave the EU when we're supposed to, those sort of things might start happening over here in Britain. And the next bit in the article refers to Boris Johnson. It calls him a very much larger than life political figure who is being compared to strongman US President Donald Trump. He is set to battle the Remainer-dominated House of Commons to deliver Brexit as pledged by October the 31st. So they're noticing what you were pointing out there, Max. And they say, of all those questioned, just over one quarter, 26%, said that it would be good having the army run the country. So over a quarter of the people tested think that it would be much better if we actually have the army running the country. Can you ever recall a time apart from when we've been at war when we had the army running the country over here, Max?
No, I don't think there ever has been an occasion when we've had the army running the country. So I mean, it's quite amazing, actually. You know, I don't think it would be a good thing to have the army running the country. I think it would be, but it may eventually prove to be a necessary thing. But the point is, as I explained a little while ago, that the driver of all of this is where you have people who have been elected into high office within the establishment, the political establishment within a country, whether it's in a parliamentary an elected position, or whether they are part of the mass media that is the information distributing arm of the nation. When those people abuse their position, that's when they are they're chipping away at the foundations of democracy. And if that what they really want is democracy, they've got to stop abusing their position, stop chipping away at the foundations of democracy, and abide by the will of the people as expressed. Because if you continually defy the will of the people by abusing the democratic and the parliamentary means at your disposal, then you get what you ask for eventually.
Having the army take over—that's the sort of thing that happens in Egypt, or happens in Tunisia. And it does look like that, you know, that may have to happen in France if Macron doesn't step down, which shows that we're in real dire straits. If a quarter of the country think that, you know, the army should take over, a response that normally takes place in the third world and places like that. Continuing with the article, however, by age range in both questions, Onward remarked that younger voters are the most authoritarian, with 66%. Favouring strongman leaders, and when asked about the army rule, 36% back the idea. I mean, that's over a third of young people saying we need to have the army in charge. So 36% is huge to be saying that. I'm really, really surprised at this, these actual numbers, because, you just wouldn't have thought that all the youngsters are thinking we need to have the army in charge, and we need to have somebody leading that doesn't have to bother with Parliament. That also shows that people are sick to death of these Remainers and what they've been doing for the last 2 years in Parliament. Because that's the only thing that kind of turned people off from actually having Parliament there is the fact that it is Parliament and the traitors in these political parties that have frustrated the will of the people for Brexit. You know, I wonder what a poll like this would find out in America, whether their youngsters have got attitudes like this. Their findings back up research from 2017, where a study of social attitudes conducted by the University of Sheffield and the University of Southampton found young people in Britain are more right-wing than older generations, challenging the notion that younger generations are inevitably more liberal than their predecessors. And that that brings to mind an old adage that if you're not supporting Labour and the socialists at 20, then you have no heart. And if you're not supporting the right wing and the Conservative Party by the time you're 40, then you have no head. And that seems to have been reversed here.
Yeah, I think one of the other things that people need to sort of think about in this respect is that we've recently had a number of wars in the Middle East, particularly the one against Iraq, where we deposed Saddam Hussein and brought about regime change. There have been attempts at regime change in other places. And then we've got this situation in Syria where the US-led coalition have been trying to depose Bashar al-Assad. And there are these constant references to the harsh treatment that's been dished out to minority groups within Iraq and within Syria by the leaders of those countries, and it's been sort of pointed to that these leaders are effectively authoritarian leaders of the country. But the situation that we have in most Middle Eastern countries is that the populations are not homogenous. What you've got is populations that are made up of lots of little tribal groups. And when you become the leader of a country which is made up of little tribal groups, effectively you are leading a multicultural society. And what you've got within these tribal groups, particularly if the country concerned hasn't had centuries and centuries of steady rule, centuries and centuries of economic and scientific progress within those countries, where the countries have been to some extent still quite sort of rudimentary in terms of the level of civilization achieved, then what you have is a far greater propensity on the part of the people of those nations to resort to violence in order to settle any problems they have and in order to settle any political issues. And so what's needed in those Middle Eastern countries, because they are multicultural societies, and have been for millennia in some cases, but certainly for many centuries in other cases, what you need is somebody who is going to be an authoritarian leader and who can impose peace, and as a result of imposing peace can create the prosperity that enables the people to prosper. And so when you look at countries like, well, particularly Syria, I think Syria was prior to the war a very enlightened country relative to other Arab countries, and that was because there had been a succession of leaders who had passed on their power to their sons or their nephews in such a way that there hadn't been a civil war or any large conflict in the country. And so what we have in Europe, if we continue to have mass immigration from the third world so that our populations, the populations of our countries are composed of large numbers of ethnic minority groups, each of which will, because of the nature of a multicultural society, will inevitably be induced into competing with the other ethnic minority groups for finite resources, and will inevitably be drawn into practicing an in-group and out-group preference, with in-group preference for their own people. What you'll have is you're creating the conditions within our country that the only solution to those conditions is an authoritarian leader who can use the military in order to impose his political will on the seething mass of different peoples that are all competing for prominence, and And it becomes a self-fulfilling thing. And again, this is one of the things that that people on the liberal left need to take account of, that it is only because we've had many centuries, and in fact many millennia, of having a homogeneous population in this country that has led to a situation whereby we can have a society that is as free as our society has been up until recently, and where we have societies that are as wealthy as our societies have been. It's not just luck. It's not because we've that we've purloined other people's wealth in the way that some lefties try and imply. It's because we have had a homogeneous society, so that there hasn't been this constant fighting between rival ethnic groups, that has enabled us to have the prosperity and the peace that we've enjoyed for so many centuries. And if you undermine that homogeneous situation within the population, what you're doing is you're chipping away again at the foundations of democracy. You're creating the conditions where democracy will ultimately be replaced by something more forceful.
Something in accordance with natural law. You know, nature will not be mocked. You can't start importing all these foreigners into the country without society breaking down and a strongman leader being needed. And obviously that's understood. That's instinctively understood by the population who are now calling for this. And I think the next part of the article, I think this is actually referring to the multiculturalism that we have in the cities. Onward also found that in terms of social and cultural issues, people were expressing more conservative, traditional values than 50 years of liberalism would have predicted, with 71% of people thinking that more people living in cities has made society worse, 66% saying that more people going to university and fewer gaining technical qualifications has been bad for the country overall, and 63% believing that fewer people are getting married because of a decline in family commitment and values. So we've got the traditionalism there. People are recognising that it's this lack of traditionalism that's causing this breakdown in family life. It's a total waste to be sending people to university that haven't got the intelligence to actually be there, shouldn't even be there. But more people living in cities has made society worse. Where have all these more people come from that are now living in the cities? They're all foreigners. We're not producing enough to reproduce ourselves. So all these people that are coming to these cities that are making society worse, it's all the non-whites. So again, I think that's understood at an instinctual level, that's the cause of this. I mean, I've always been anti-city life. I've always thought people in cities can't be trusted. There's so much more crime there. They're emotionally immature. And people in the rural areas, they're much more like real people. You can trust them. Of course, I understand today that the reason for that is the multiculturalism that's there in the cities. Because if you go to a city that just has white people in it, if you go to somewhere like Riga in Latvia or Vilnius in Lithuania that's still 99% white, it's just as safe as living in the country. You know, you can leave your iPad on the table and walk off and come back half an hour later and the iPad will still be there on the table. It will be saving your seat. You certainly couldn't do that in a multicultural city. And there's also no litter there. It's all about race. That's the reason why the cities now have become so dangerous, is because they're multicultural. And I think this shows that people understand that. 71% of people said that more people living in the cities has made society worse. And that's the reason for it. Continuing, respondents also did not have a lot positive to say about globalization, with 66% of people thinking that globalization has not benefited most people, with 61% of people believing that on the whole, jobs and wages have been made worse by technological change. More than half, 59%, have said that increases in immigration have had a negative impact on the economy overall, compared to 41% who said the impact has been positive. Again, that shows that the brainwashing that we get in the media, that immigration is good for us and it's great for the economy, people aren't buying it. They're not having it. You know, more than half are saying, well, no, it's not. It's having a negative effect on the economy. And all these people, 61%, saying that they don't want globalization. So why are the politicians pushing for more globalization? You know, this shows that there is a big pushback against all of the liberal agenda, which they really didn't predict. They thought that everybody was going to be super liberal by the time we got to 2019, and they're not. Everybody is turning against it, and the majority of them are these Zoomers. And this is fantastic news, I think, Max.
Yeah, I think this shows that people, certainly our electorate, are far brighter than our politicians gave them credit for. They've seen Parliament, they've seen MPs floundering over several decades now, and the outcome, the fruits of the kind of liberal left government that we've had over that period of time, the fruits of that kind of government are becoming so apparent now that it's almost impossible to avoid seeing the truth now. And it's good. It's really good and heartening to see that lots of young people particularly are realizing what side their bread's buttered on. And let's hope that they've got the determination to act in such a way that it's brings to fruition the things that their hearts desire.
Well, it's not only Britain that this is going on in as well. Britain is not the only European country where the younger demographic is turning to the right, with an academic finding that young Poles who travelled westwards, instead of liberalising, are having their Eastern European conservatism and traditionalism reinforced. Alex Zerbiak, a professor of politics at the University of Sussex, said in 2017 it was long assumed that young Poles would come to the West and become more secular, multicultural and liberal, and that they would re-export those things back to Poland. But instead, their experience of the West seems to have reinforced their social conservatism and traditionalism in many ways. How could that have happened? How could they not have seen the gay pride and thought, oh, this is wonderful, we want to bring this back to Poland? You know, they've come to the decadent West and they've been absolutely sickened by what they've seen. They've seen rape gangs roaming the streets. They've seen stabbings occurring in all these multicultural cities. They've seen the mainstream media attacking the indigenous people of Britain and covering up for the crimes and accusing people of being racist for pointing out crimes that non-whites are carrying out. They've seen five-year-olds being brainwashed into thinking that they should be chopping their genitals off and taking the opposite sex's hormones. They've seen children being taught about the wonders of sodomy. You know, of course they're not going to want to bring that back to Poland. They're going to be absolutely sickened at that. When they go back to Poland, they're going to be saying, you know, well, we definitely want to be voting for the most hardcore far-right parties we can, because we don't want to end up like Britain and Sweden and France and Germany. Just look at the state of those countries. I mean, this is totally confounded liberalism, basically, this poll.
Yes, it's like giving people day trips to Weimar Germany or to Sodom and Gomorrah, and yeah, then being surprised when people come back not liking what they've seen.
Yeah, it's like, you know, the Holocaust believers, you know, they say, well, we should be shipping people off to the Auschwitz camps so that they you know, so that they never again criticise Jews. And, you know, it's a similar thing to this. It's all these people that have come to Britain, come to the West looking for jobs, they've been absolutely disgusted by what they've seen. And they're going to make certain that their East European countries don't end up going the same way. Yeah, really, really pleased with this, and good on the Zoomers for basically realizing that they're being lied to. And just before we finish today, I just wanted to remind people that we have got a Bitcoin wallet and we do rely on donations. Last month, we ended up having the site taken down. We ended up having to get a new server, and we actually got the site back again. But we're still going to be transferring to this new server, and we'd actually laid out the money for that. So it would be helpful if people could send some donations in. They were a bit light last month. And I don't very often mention it. I'm not somebody that likes to ask for money. I'm not one of these grifter types. But we do require money to keep the site going, and your donations are gratefully received, and you'll find the Bitcoin wallet in the sidebar at the website. Max, thank you very much for coming on today. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We'll be back next Monday with more Air in Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you all have a great week ahead of you.
listening to Radio Aryan for an alternative to the anti-white system on RadioAryan.com.